the Lutheran Church of America involved in the area of alcohol and drug problem ministry. I wanted to begin, because you're probably wondering, why is this a concern if I asked you if you thought of somebody that had an alcohol or a drug problem? Let me just ask, what age would you think of anybody?
Any age?
Any age?
40, 50.
40, 50, okay. Anybody else?
20.
20? Any age, okay. 16, all right.
75?
All right, it's going up. But I'll give you a definition of some problems and see if you have any that relate to people that you might know. The term drug misuse is kind of cloudy, but I'll give you some situations that you may have knowledge of someone or an acquaintance that you know that may have this circumstance. First, there is the situation of a person who asks for the refill of a medication long after the rational need for the drug has disappeared. Second is a person who discontinues the use of a prescribed drug which produces unpleasant side effects. The third is a situation, if you know of anyone, who exchanges his or her medications with friends. You know, I've seen this at some senior citizen groups. Here's a green one, Mabel. Here's a red one. This helps for the knee. And who claim to have the same ailment. Fourth is the situation of a person who removes his or her medication from the prescription container and places them in a pill box and mixes them all together, like when they come to hold them, so that they have enough to take and they don't want to pack too much. Okay? Fifth is the situation of a person who forgets to take their medication. Somebody's nodding over there. I see that struck a chord. Sixth is a person who forgets to take his or her medication and doubles the next dose and then has an incorrect dosage. Seventh is the person who takes medication other than the prescribed medication by the physicians, self-medicates themselves, in other words, or takes the prescription and then in addition takes the other things over the counter because they see it advertised and remembered that. Eighth is the person who mixes alcohol with depressant drugs, and by depressant drugs we mean Valium, Librium, sleeping pills, minor tranquilizers, and antihistamine have an additive effect or impede the desired effect. And finally, the person who has who is ignorant of why the medication is prescribed, how it is to be taken, and when it is to be taken. Those are the kinds of situations that we have that are considered in the area of drug misuse, and I'm going to be talking about the problems that come about when there are drug interactions, drugs in combination with alcohol. What is our responsibility to persons in the church, and how can we help older adults with education and concern and knowledge? Are there any of these things that I mentioned that strike a chord if anybody wants to share some situations that you've heard or experienced of the kind of things that I just mentioned?
One time I was taking certain medication, and I had forgotten that I had already taken my dosage for it. It was a 12-hour pill, and I took another one within maybe 2 hours, and I didn't know anything for about 2 weeks after that.
You doubled up, and you had it. Well, that's called a drug toxic effect.
I recall hearing a fellow tell about his father, who was a diabetic, and his father, before he would go on a bender, he would take a double dose of insulin. Evidently that was a very helpful thing to him in his program of alcohol. But then I was also wondering about this Valium alcohol combination thing, because I know people that are into that.
Anybody know Dorothy Kilgallen? Remember her?
Yeah.
Okay, and Marilyn Monroe?
Yeah.
They were taking their tranquilizer or barbiturate, and instead of washing it down with water, took a highball and then forgot. I take my sleeping pill, you know, and they start getting drowsy, sleepy. And then they had what happens is that a tranquilizer with alcohol or barbiturate is not a 1 and 1 plus 2. It equals 1 plus 2 equals 3 or 4. In other words, you overload your body faster than the body can oxidate or burn it up. And so in a short period of time, you've doubled or tripled the effect by taking it with another drug of the sedation family. So that's what's happening. I have a chart over here.
That's fine.
For those who are interested, alcohol when taken with a variety of drugs may cause, and then it's listed for you, for those who are interested, and you had the anti-diabetic agents. If you take alcohol with it, you could get hypoglycemia, and the insulin potentiates the effects of the alcohol. It's exactly what you're talking about. For that person did have an alcohol problem and wanted to get a higher boost out of it. How about any other situations that might have...
A friend of ours was taking drugs prescribed by the doctor and for various problems. They come and go, arthritis and lots of different things. But then she'd go again and he would prescribe something else. But then she continued to take the other things that he prescribed, and then she'd take the new one, you know, and she, you know, didn't live too long. She didn't die from drug abuse exactly, but she had no resistance to anything and was very weak all the time.
Yes.
She actually one time was on 37, I think it was, different types of pills.
37 different types.
I call that drug abuse by the doctor.
Okay. I would tend to agree with you. Are any doctors in the house?
Well, how about vitamin pills? A lot of people take a lot of vitamin pills.
Okay, I'm not a medical person, and I'll fall back on a very helpful book, and it's called The Elderly, Their Health, and the Drugs in Their Lives, and it's printed in large print. It has an excellent chapter on drug interactions, and listed for you are common over-the-counter drugs, when taken with a whole bunch of different other drugs, may cause, and the comments on each of them. And you'd be welcome to go through that. If you have certain medications, you can find and see the relationships of drugs in combination and other drug families, and you'll see the results, because it's lengthy, and I don't want to get into it. That's not my particular field. I want to alert you to the whole issue.
Can one obtain a copy of that book?
Yes, I have this 3.5, and you can write to the press that I have listed on the top of the blackboard. Let me tell you some situations that some pastors shared with me, and that's what started my interest. A pastor who's 35 years in an urban Philadelphia congregation, a very substantial congregation, where the members are wealthy and now elderly, living off of coupons. He had a woman working in the helping with the congregation mailings. She's 82, and he had another member, 86. Both women were sipping wine, and the one woman came to him and said, "Pastor, I don't think I can help out anymore with the mailings. I just really can't make it anymore." But what she was really saying is that there was something else going on in her life, and he began to see her appearance start to go. She appeared disheveled. Once he heard that she passed out on the street, so he contacted me and asked, "What can I do in this kind of situation?" But in both cases, both of the women were starting to weave while walking on the street in downtown Philadelphia. The pastor was afraid of the potential for mugging and purse snatching. A 74-year-old woman in a suburban setting has also a senile friend living with her. When the pastor comes to visit, she's one of the shut-ins of the congregation, she's always zonked out. She's like slurred in her speech. And he's wondering what in the world's going on, and he found out that she's taking Valium 3 times a day. But instead of taking it morning, afternoon, and evening, she takes all 3 in the morning, and he always visits her in the morning. So when he comes to visit her, she's spaced out and is not taking her dosage correctly. A mother of a pastor, age 70, in a rural setting, developed a problem around alcohol and tranquilizer use, although there was no previous alcohol history or any problem. A 55-year-old disabled rural parishioner developed an alcohol problem and while using many painkillers for his disabled condition. The man was extremely active in his life. In fact, he was the committee man for one of the political parties, and he was extremely active in his local community affairs. Now disabled, he was unable to get out, and that probably had a lot to do with it. And these were some of the situations that began to spark my interest, and I tried to check the literature, so I'm going to give you some statistics, because everyone asks, is there really a problem with older people? Because I think in general, we think in terms of the youth, everybody's concerned about teenage drinking, and my basic concern in that area is that alcohol is the drug of the adult generation, of our generation. That is, if you prefer to drink, it is the drug of the adult generation. There are those people who choose to be abstinent. That is their choice, and that should be so honored by persons who do drink alcoholic beverages, and in the same manner, abstinent persons should not feel that they are superior, and vice versa. But in any case, I did try to check the literature, and it seems that the over 65 adult population has increased from 3 million in 1900 to 23 million in 1975. And by 2000, it is estimated that there will be 30% of the population will be older adults when the post-war baby boom comes of age. The United States Department of Health, HEW, indicates that there are, in 1974, 1 million alcoholics over the age of 55 in the United States. And you always have to be leery of these things, because the figures for alcoholism, you know, here, 9 million, I started in this field in 1971, and then all of a sudden, the next time I went to a conference in Washington, it jumped up. First it was 6 million in 71, then the next year later it was 9 million, and then now they're talking in terms of 12 million. Well, where do they get these figures? They come from liver cirrhotic deaths, and they project them over a broad-based population. But there's a lot of, you know, question in that whole area, because for years, the coroners were not listing liver cirrhotic deaths because they were covering it up. So you always have to question those kinds of figures, but they're extensive, at least. I'm sure it's, you know, at least in the area of 9 to 12 million. There are some figures from surveys of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in 1971, a survey of 11,000 Alcoholics Anonymous members in New York City indicated that 30% of the members of AA surveyed were age 50 to 64, 30% age 50 to 64, and 4% were age 65 and over. There is a drug alert system which reports overdoses in a series of a few hundred hospitals in the United States, and the Miami hospital, which has a large elderly population in Miami, reports that 6% of all drug overdoses are by older persons, and the overdoses were not for illegal drugs but for legally prescribed drugs such as Valium, Tylenol, and phenobarbiturate. There is a pharmacist, a doctor of pharmacology, Ron Gaetano, is the author of this book, in Broome County, New York, who has a drug awareness center, says that 30% of all the calls to Broome County, New York drug hotline are by older persons. And older persons that came over age 55. And from that he makes a projection that 7.5% of all persons over 55 are problem drinkers. Projected nationally, that would come to about 1 million problem drinkers. There is another bit of information. There's a program that the National Institute of Drug Abuse has called Elder Ed, Elder Education, for the prevention of medication for the elderly. They indicated that there are 11.4 prescriptions per year for the elderly compared to 4.0 prescriptions for under 65. The elderly paid $2.6 billion in 1975 for prescriptions. That's $87 a year for drugs, over twice what younger adults pay. In testimony to Congress, the Honorable Howard Robinson said, while individuals over the age of 65 constitute less than 10% of the total population, they received at the same time 25% of all prescription drugs. 10% of the population receives 25% of all prescription drugs. That's a lot of drugs. And the case that you cited, a woman with 37 different medications? The elderly, and this is important, the elderly are less capable of metabolizing most drugs and are more susceptible to direct side and interaction effects and may require smaller dosages. Just let me make a footnote. We have a man who's the medical director of the hospital where I work, and he's very sharp, 34, psychiatrist, and with a doctorate in pharmacology. He said that the medication dosages are experimented on medical students, age 22, male. So the body weight is about 160, 180 pounds. There are literally no experimental dosages on females. And when we get dosages as adults, for the most part, there is no consideration taken by the doctor for a gerontological dosage. It is the same dosage that is given based on actual experiment by giving them to males who are in their prime of life. So what conclusions can we get from this? One is that older persons are least visible if they have a problem with alcohol. That's one consideration. It is this generation that is the most stigmatized, having gone through the controversy, the wet-dry struggle, prohibition, and all that, and all that that means, that period. And the word alcoholic or addict is the most stigmatizing word that this generation feels, and they would be, therefore, if they were indicated or labeled as that, they would be out of the mainstream or in the pale of American society. Secondly, an observation is that there is an overabundance of prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs, and the prevalence of ailments among elderly make them very susceptible to drug interactions. When you combine the drugs that elderly take with alcohol, you have what is called an additive, or the highfalutin word is synergistic, or an inhibitory effect of drugs in combination. Elderly are less capable of metabolizing. Why? Because the body systems start slowing down. Your liver can't assimilate as much, your heart and all of this, your intestinal organs, all of these organs cannot function at the capacities when you were younger and in the prime of your life. So we have difficulty in metabolizing most drugs, and therefore we require smaller dosages. Third, older adults swap pills and they need to be less accepting of drugs. The practice of automatic refills can lead to an accumulation of drugs, which encourages sharing and self-medication. No drugs should be kept over a two-year period because the potency is gone. That's another thing. Sunlight, windows. You walk in and visit shut-ins. And in my former congregation, I had about 345 members, and there were 90 over 65. I had 41 shut-ins. And how many times did I see in the kitchen sunlight, you know, I never dawned on me, okay? But there the drugs are, they're in the window, and the sun hits them, and the sun breaks down the chemical compounds of the drugs. Fourth, another observation is that drugs are taken often by older adults in an attempt to restore what I call the Ponce de Leon feeling, getting back the youthful feelings, in an effort to overcome what is really a feeling of powerlessness. Powerlessness to control a constantly changing, difficult life circumstance. And fifth, older adults need help with alcohol and drug problems, who, if they do have a problem, they need help. And if there is an older adult, it's really hard for them to get help because they get the runaround from the treatment agencies and they fall through the cracks. By that I mean there's a program for teenagers, there's a program for adults, there's a program for women, there's a program, possibly the Salvation Army program, a mission kind of program, and a person who is an older adult gets kind of shoved around, and there's no one agency that can meet their needs. So I've tried to present to you so far kind of a national scope of the problem and how older adults are affected, and I want to make two comments in relation to problem drinking situations for older adults. I think there are some basic problems for persons that have been drinking for a period of time, and then there are environmental conditions. And environmental situations that affect drinking, problem drinking, include transition things such as bereavement, death, infirmity, marital stress, retirement, and feelings of loss. There is a man who has studied the incidence of problem drinking, named Don Cahill at the University of California, Berkeley, talks about a bimodal hump. And he talks about in males age 31 to 35 is a high stress period. They're trying to be moving up in middle management. One of the ways to get accepted is in liquor is part of it, and parties and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of stress and tension. There's also the empty nest syndrome when the age 45, 48, and that's a difficult period for a lot of people when that happens. And those are environmental kinds of things. And often the death of a spouse can be the root of the exacerbation of drinking or the exaggerated sudden drinking kind of phenomenon. And I feel that the church should really be an expert in helping people in this kind of difficult transition ministry, because we've all talked about listening, we've talked about caring, we've talked about wholeness, and feelings of loss are very difficult for some people, and an active, sensitive pastoral ministry of both pastor and people would help in this area. I want to talk, why is the issue of alcohol, drugs, and older adults a concern for the church? And there are some particular concerns I'm going to single out for the pastor, but I think they also apply to visitation leaders in a congregation, social ministry kinds of persons, and for the whole congregation. It's the biblical imperative from Jesus in Matthew 25, "For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. I say to you, as you did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me." The pastor and the congregation represent for many older people the only people who really care and count to them, because trusted friends, family members are at distances, and the fellowship of believers, the family of God, represents for them their real, immediate, significant other persons. And there are particular roles I'm going to talk about for the pastor, and I guess for leaders and deaconesses that would fit in the same category. But the pastor is seen as a friend, counselor, and in addition to being the pastor. So many times the family doctor does not have time. The pastor is the one, though, that can listen and is appreciated for his listening. And I've heard that from many of you in your senior groups here, how you appreciate the fact of listening and support that you do get with the pastor who does work and actively seeks to fulfill this role. And it is the pastor who can help an older adult experience, and Dr. Schatz very related a situation how he spent through the night with someone in a grieving situation and feelings of loss, rather than escaping through drugs. I have a lot of difficulty with the practice of medicating people to deny them the experience of guilt, not guilt, but of grief. Well, there is guilt attached for some in their grief. But I have a lot of difficulty for people at this point, because I think it's something we should try to go through and experience. And what we should rely on is the human contact that we would give to one another. Many times the pastor is called upon, because of his unique relationship, to be a community organizer, public speaker, and community group liaison person. And why is that important with older adults? Because many times an older adult is unable to cope with the lack of public services. And it's, if you're living in a small town and everybody knows widow so-and-so and goes over and helps her, cuts the grass, goes shopping, transports, and those kinds of things, you've got a built-in support system. But when you get into an urban kind of setting, or if you get into an apartment complex where that does not exist, you need services. I grew up in my former parish was in a community, and they said, we're town and country, we're not city, and they used the name Roxburgh, which is a section, rather than Philadelphia. And they, you know, rather than saying they're from Philadelphia, they said they're from Roxburgh. Well, we have had to try to help people who were moving into the community, because everybody always had family members that would help them out. So there is now Phish, and how many of you know Phish? Okay, that's known to you. And Contact, a telephone kind of reassurance ministry, friends in supplying help. There are senior citizen groups, of which you're very familiar with. There are Meals on Wheels. Why do you have to have Meals on Wheels? Well, because it's not because they're too lazy to cook or anything like that, because everybody that has a family figures, well, we're cooking, why in the world can't they cook? Well, something's happened to somebody, an infirmity, or they can't go out and shop as easily as they would like. And Meals on Wheels are a godsend. And those are the kinds of things that we in the church have got to continue to support and increasingly find new and creative ways to enlarge that outreach, as well as visiting nurses and so forth. Okay, the pastor is also called on to be an ombudsman for older adults, and that's a fancy term for someone who will represent you in your place and help you out. And that's in the case where the elderly have few friends, the family is elsewhere, and the pastor is called on to speak to the public authorities for neglected public services. And there's a new role that I think we've got to take a look at, not only for pastor, but for social ministry and for us as concerned persons in the church, and that is to interpret the aging process, to explode the myths that are around. What are some of the myths? Well, one of the major myths that fortunately Senator Pepper, who was, I don't know, 76 in Congress, finally got Congress to change, was that you have to retire at age 65. Because when you're 65, you've had it. You're old and you're done. Well, the reality is that at age 75, there are physiological changes that take place, psychological, sociological, and so forth. And there is a thing called economic aging. If you were to take someone from Seattle who is a longshoreman, and at age 45, say this guy has a fifth grade education, he is not able to compete anymore. He's already aged at 45. Economically, he's aged at that point. He's got a difficulty, and the aging process is going to hit that guy at a different age. So, you know, there's a myth that at 65, and there are lots of myths involved with aging. My wife and I have gone to pre-retirement conferences and to begin thinking, so hopefully that I can get my own feelings worked out for my own self in time. And I think the pre-retired are the most numerous in our church, and we've got to help them and change our attitudes, which I hope you'll see a little bit later. Because the pre-retired are faithful, regularly committed persons in our church, and are the survivors of the drug age, this phenomenon, this explosion that came after penicillin was invented. Naturally, the pastor is going to be a big help to someone who's identified who needs help and needs treatment. And he's going to help that person and be a guide and re-entry into the life stream. And there are certain ways to intervene with a person who does have an alcohol drug problem. First, I think, though, we would all involved with a person have to look at our attitudes. That is pastors too, because for the most part, pastors have not been trained how to intervene with an alcohol drug problem. Just as it may shock you to know that most doctors have had perhaps only 2 hours of instruction dealing with alcoholism, the progressive nature of alcoholism, the disease concept. It takes about 10 to 20 years for the classical model of alcoholism to emerge. And the proof of this is that the federal government has established a career addiction scholar program. They are paying doctors anywhere from a base of $20,000 in addition to other income that they would get from the university, but their commitment is to develop addiction curricula in the medical schools. They're doing that with nursing, and they're going to be doing it with social work. So we're at the awareness development in the field, and hopefully in the training of pastors, this will come too. So the reason I say this is because many pastors get a situation when it's just like dumped on them, and it's so frustrating, and after a couple of those frustrating situations, that attitude comes off in dealing with a person with a problem. Just the same attitude that many people in a family have who become frustrated. That's just one of the kinds of things. But there's an attitude in regard to older persons that I would like to ask all of us to take a look at. There's a man named Claude Steiner who deals with transactional analysis, and he has a book called Games Alcoholics Play, and he says, watch out when the drinking person winks, you know, and he says to the wife, you know, he says, it's Christmas dinner, and she says, now, please, please make sure you're sober because mom and pop are coming, the whole family's coming, and he says, right, and he winks. So, and then what happens? Everything breaks, a horrible mess, the Christmas dinner is ruined, and she says, but you promised. And then it goes on and it repeats itself for New Year's and Easter or whatever. Now, what bothers me though is the attitude when either pastor and people wink at an older person who has a problem. And these are some of the things that I've heard said. Well, let them have their kicks. Oh, you even deny that to an older person? What the heck? It's their only pleasure. I mean, they paid their dues. What, do you want to be a spoil sport? I mean, you know, they've earned it. Leave them alone. Have you ever heard that said about an older person with a problem?
Many times.
Many times, okay. Now, that kind of an attitude would block an intervention. Just suppose the pastor that in Philadelphia who had an 82 and 86-year-old parishioner had felt that, and that would have, you know, been, I feel, very destructive. And I'm going to say, you know, about intervention, it is possible people can be helped, and I want to say I feel that we have a moral right to intervene. But there's something funny that operates when you get into the area of drinking, because you say, oh, that's personal, I don't want to meddle, I don't want to interfere. Let me tell you about Mr. Jones in my former congregation. Mr. Jones was happened to be my first marriage. I didn't have too many marriages or baptisms, but Mr. Jones was 75 years old, and he married his housekeeper, but he was a locksmith and a repairer of clocks. And he had so many locks and clocks that they were all over the kitchen table, the dining room table. They were all over the place. Well, and he happened to have an ulcerated sores on his leg, and he believed that cooked onions were the thing to put on these open ulcerated sores, and he wrapped them in a paper towel with a rubber band around them. The only thing that I think was saving grace was that he used Fisahex, until I learned that Fisahex wasn't supposed to be that good anyhow. But every time I came, he would take that, here, Pastor, look at my foot, and he would shove this horrible smelling foot in my face. And every time I saw this, you know, I had this tremendous fight. I started to go for him. Come on, we're going to the doctor. Oh, no, I'm not going to the doctor. Okay, and we go through this. But the point I'm trying to make out is that this is a very clearly seen physical problem. And immediately, we all want to help and do something and get him to the doctor. It's very obvious that this leg began to affect this man's whole life. In fact, this leg made his life, what we would say, unmanageable. Now, if Mr. Jones had an alcohol or drug problem in his life, which made his life unmanageable, why wouldn't a concerned person want to intervene to offer an opportunity for wholeness? Because a lot of times we get either frightened, fears come up in us, and a whole bunch of other things. I don't have time, but let me just mention that there are some 20 questions which are effectively can be used and have the person help to diagnose themselves. That's one little way that you can help. And these 20 questions will help a person, you know, examine if they had blackouts, if they require a drink at a certain time, if they have ever tremors or those kinds of things. And that's possible with kind of a pastoral interview, having the person examine their own drinking pattern rather than saying, you're an alcoholic. That's one way. But it is difficult to make an intervention in American affluent society because it's possible to avoid a crisis. Now, one of the concepts of intervention is the only two ways I know that people can stop an addiction is one is that somehow by ourselves we experience that our life is so meaningful that we say, I don't need it, it's kid stuff, and we give it up. The other is that we experience a crisis whereby we are made to be responsible for the consequences of our drinking or addictive behavior, and that the pain is so great that we no longer can stand the cost. And you hear a person say, I'm just was sick and tired of being sick and tired. You'll hear that said. So that the pain of constantly banging your head and having this situation come around makes it so much that you really have to, you just need help and you admit it and reach out for help. Okay, there is a process called the surround process. And that is, in working with a person who has an alcohol problem, you surround the person with persons who are most important. Let's say possibly the pastor, possibly a doctor, the wife, a child, children. And everyone has to be, one, educated about the disease process of alcoholism, has to know their own attitudes. They have to, in one sentence, give their feelings. You know, like the son would say, Dad, I really don't know how to trust you anymore. One day you give me big presents, the next day you beat the hell out of me. And the person is just torn like this. And then what you need to do is go to the detox center, you need to go to a treatment center, and then you need to follow up with AA. And each person says the same thing. You've got to go to the detox center, you've got to go to the treatment center, and then you have to go to AA. And what you give is a uniformly agreed upon treatment and aftercare plan. Each person says the same thing. One of the things with a person with an alcohol or drug problem is they try to keep it a secret. They don't let anybody know. Don't let mom know. Don't tell your sister. So nobody's supposed to know. The minister's not supposed to know. The doctor's not supposed to know. And finally, when the pressure gets on, he says, okay, I'll go to the minister. Okay, just keep quiet, I'll go to the minister. And then he says, okay, I'll go to the doctor. Okay. Just to keep the peace, okay? And now you get them together, and you have what is called a surround. And it's difficult to arrange. And it causes a pressure on the person. And it's the beauty of it is that it creates a crisis for people who might be able to get out of a crisis because of status, money, and position. If you have a businessman, he has a secretary, she alibis. A husband's wife, she alibis out of fear, ignorance, and so forth. Now, let's move along to the older person. There are no friends left, very few. There are no family members who are close at hand. How can you get a surround process? It is difficult, I grant you, but there are people in the church family who can be a surrogate family, who can be a family to that person. And the older adult has learned to be self-sufficient. They've learned not to ask for help. And that kind of supports them in their aloneness. And then in self-pity and self-remorse, they keep going on a dangerous treadmill. Another way of intervening is a direct one that comes out of an environmental situation. I had a situation where both the president of the church council and a treasurer had an alcohol problem. And we were arguing mission of the church statements. And I used to wonder why the meetings would go on and on. And I remember I had to go to the doctor for high blood pressure one time because it was just unbelievable to me. I couldn't believe why these men weren't really with it as far as the work of the church. And I, you know, realized the one had an alcohol problem, but I didn't know that the council president was popping Librium and drinking mixed in with it. But his wife began to drink, okay? The council president ultimately died through liver ailment, and his wife began to develop alcoholism afterward. And she couldn't cope with the grief situation and the loneliness. And I became involved with her in some very directive counseling. And I, you know, in no uncertain terms, I had that relationship with her. And literally hooked her up with the senior citizen group. She got involved, became a greeter. She's very anxious at night, at time when she's alone. And she reads sometimes 7 and 8 books a week. I admire, you know, being able to read 7 or 8 books. I'd like to. But it beats taking overdoses of sleeping medication and other things, and she is maintaining herself because she has involvements which are meaningful to her. And that comes with a kind of direct involvement. I want to move now to the areas for pastoral ministry involving church homes and retirement villages and going over prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs. If you all remember President Ford's wife, Betty Ford, she is a public illustration of the issues about prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs, the issues of medication and drug interactions, reduced metabolism for older adults, and the added effect that she experienced with alcohol. And these are issues for persons of all ages, but particularly critical for older adults because of the quantity of drugs so high. It's an issue for church homes and for retirement homes. Let me just say that we need to encourage non-chemical means of stimulation. I am thrilled that here at Holden there is an intergenerational approach, that it is possible to have all ages here. Even though there are seniors here in concentration this week, I know that so many of us have said, wow, wasn't it terrific? I mean, I can't get with Frodo and Bobo and all that, but anyhow, I really appreciated what the young people did. I think it was just fantastic. And I heard that said time and time again. And the reason I'm saying about the stimulation part, it's great to see the serious concern and discussion and the level of discussion in the buzz groups in the theology that was being considered and the other issues and interests. One of the things that concerns me about senior citizen programs is what we do to senior citizens with only bingo or that type of a format. And I'm not knocking bingo. I'm also concerned about the overuse of television and as it affects both young and old, but I guess I'm concerned that there be stimulation for older adults. That's the issue. Educational stimulation. I don't know if you're aware of it, but the National Center for Aging has a special program on the humanities with sections developed for senior citizens, and that's the kind of thing that I think would really help. There's also an elder hostel study program. I don't know, is anybody familiar with that? There are colleges, about 50 or so in this country. You can literally plan your vacation by taking mini courses in colleges across this country when there are break times, and you can get credits if you wish. You can just take courses and experience that kind of stimulation, and I think we've got to look at that. Another area that we need to look at is what we frequently say of the early church, see how they love one another. That kind of human contact, the relatedness and meaning of life comes through people and relationships, the experience of the love of God. I once was in the mental hospital in a quarter clinical training, and I introduced myself. I'm Chaplain Schneider, intern, and this woman just kept sweeping the stairs and just didn't bother with me. And I said, I'm Chaplain Schneider, you know, and she said, you show me that you love me, and then I'll know that God loves me. And I never forgot that. You show me that you care, then I'll know that God cares. And that's the way God works through human relationships, and he works in the personal and the physical touch of caring people. And that's important when we look at programming for church homes and for retirement homes. And I think we also need to look at the discussion of the role of alcohol in these areas. There have been experiments in nursing and convalescent homes where beer or a cocktail party was introduced on a limited basis with some very interesting results. The patients really responded, they used less medication, and they got involved with activities to a much greater degree, and in one of the cases that were cited, they even participated more in chapel. I don't know what that had to do with it, but they did. But there's a doctor who cites Dr. Zimberg some considerations to consider before you establish alcohol as a therapeutic agent in a nursing home on a widespread basis. One is that alcohol is, despite the fact that the liquor beverage industry makes quite a bit of money, and despite the fact that it is one of our greatest sources of tax revenue in the United States, it is a potentially addictive drug, though it is called a beverage. And patients who are elderly may develop a tolerance to it faster with a small amount, okay? And they may seek to obtain alcohol through other channels. They may send out their own persons to go out and get them some more. You know, that's one possibility. And that may cause some management problems. Elderly develop tolerance greater than young people, so they might have some behavioral problems. And the other question is the viability of introducing a drug to improve behavior when meaningful involvement in a therapeutic community kind of arrangement would be much more beneficial to the individuals if there was a non-chemical kind of stimulation that would give them both an independent, responsible living and a meaningful interdependence. There's also the growing issue with retirement villages, and persons who are not accustomed to having a cocktail party because of the need of taking people who formerly were in their own community, now living together, strangers trying to promote fellowship, that they might fall into a pattern which they're not accustomed, and they need to constantly monitor their personal drinking and entertaining pattern if they choose to drink. And this is, I throw this out as a suggestion, a man named Dr. Ebbie Hoff, who's at the North Conway Institute, an ecumenical group in New England, when he has a party, he has the doxology sung with a pre-dinner drink. A wine toast is given, and he sings the doxology with it, and then there's a wine at the table, and that's it. He takes, with the singing of the doxology, the cocktail party atmosphere is changed. And then possibly in a church home, if they wish to do this, they might consider that as one suggestion. For persons with an alcohol drug problem background, I think it would be very difficult to be put into a home where alcohol is served, and there need to be some homes where abstinence is supported. What are some of the problem situations, then, solutions for these problem situations that I've been trying to pose? One is, I think there is a need for intergenerational involvement in the church. The church is the only agency in society that serves all persons of all ages. If you think for a moment, the school is for the children, work is for the adults, the senior citizen group is for the senior citizens, and the church is the only social agency, the only institution that has the entire family. Every week, at least 120 million persons in the United States are in contact with the church, persons of all ages. There is need for intergenerational contact. For example, when my family visits a nursing home, we take our five-year-old daughter, Christy Joy, and some of you met her in 1975, and they touch her skin. They love to touch her fair skin and her hair. And that's almost a craving of the yearning for older people to touch one another's skin and to physically touch and comfort one another with the physical touch. I'd like to say that a church retirement home in Georgia that I recently visited in Georgia, the Church of Christ Christian Towers Retirement Village, they assign families to the retirement village. So the families each take a member or couple in the retirement village, and the family is assigned to that family. So they have a surrogate family. And what happens for the children, they have a grandmother and grandfather in addition to their own grandmother and grandfather, and they just think that's great. The parents can just, you know, let them go visit, and it's just fantastic in terms of support, babysitting, and all the rest that goes on. But it's just a little simple thing that helps to promote that kind of intergenerational contact. As you know, seniors make excellent babysitters and listeners, and they're very patient tutors for young learners. Now I'm going to move to the area of involvement of a role for the pastor. The pastor knows generally the medical doctor of parishioners and the preferred funeral director. Do we really know the medications taken by a parishioner? And you may say, hey, that's crazy. That's so nutty an idea, and I guess it is. It's new. But, and you know, all the rest I have to do now, I have to learn their medications. How am I going to do that? Well, I know that I have administered Holy Communion over a table of medications, and I did not know what's in all those medications. Okay? And there's that 76-year-old parishioner who zonked out on three Valiums taken at one time. Okay, now the pastor needs to know, to help that person, what should be the method of dosage. And we may need to help the person who can't read, who loses their glasses, who's a non-reader. And you know, there are some illiterate older adults. I also work very closely with illiteracy in this treatment program. And maybe we have to, when they get that prescription typed, we may have to put on it a sun. Maybe we have to put on a heart for the one medication that's heart medication with a drawing. Or we have to put a moon or paste something on there, a picture, to picturalize this for a person so that we can help them. That a visiting team from the congregation could also help and have knowledge of. I think that we need to help our parishioners have a complete list of medication of prescriptions and non-prescription drugs filled out with a copy to the local pharmacist, a copy to the medical doctor, and a copy to the pastor. It would require sitting down or having someone, maybe there's an intern in the congregation, maybe there's a nurse, maybe there's a pharmaceutical student, to sit down and inventory. And I remember when I was in the Army, we had a shot record, all the injections you had, what date you had them, and we carried that in our wallet. Now, that's why the dosage and frequency questions would be helpful for visitors, pastors to know, as I indicated. Pastors need to build a network of support with doctors and pharmacists. And often a pastor is asked, do you know a doctor for me, pastor? The doctor is moving. He's retiring. And what doctor can I trust? And so the pastor then could be very helpful in that area. And pastors need to encourage parishioners, because I think we have put the doctors with the white coat, elevated them to the position, I'm afraid to say, in some cases next to God. That may seem a blaspheme, but we have elevated the doctors, and I'm not taking away the trust in the doctor. But we need to speak up to doctors. It is the older generation has been trained, I am the doctor, what do you think, what do you have me for? You know, when you hear once that kind of thing, you're not going to talk back to the doctor. And there are some things that you and I have got to ask the doctor. And I have them listed for you if you're interested. First of all, you have to say to the doctor, what is my condition called? How does it affect my body, this medication that you're going to give me? What will happen to me if I take this medication or if I don't take the medication? And you have to tell the doctor, what other conditions do you have? Let's say you go to Dr. X and you don't like him and he treated you for this. Then you go to Dr. Y and you get some other condition going. But you didn't tell Dr. Y that you were treated by Dr. X and that you have this medication. And every now and then you take one of those and he has another medication for you. Next is, what is the name of this medication? Get it written and typed on the bottle, on the label, so that you have that. How is the medication given? In what dosage? How often? What does it do? How does it work? How long does it take to work? Does it work immediately, or do you have to wait a while for the action to take place? How long will I need to take the medication? What are the side effects? What are the restrictions, such as if I take another drug, if I take certain foods, will it affect certain activities, such as driving? What are the risks in taking the medication? Are there any alternative medications? Are there any non-chemical ways that I could get some relief in addition to the medication? Is this an accepted medication? Is it controversial? Is it experimental? How expensive? You know, one of the problems is that when we sit in the doctor's office, we start looking through the magazine for the coupons, what Pillsbury's got out for a cake contest, and we forget, and we get in the doctor's office and say, there's something else I want to ask you, and he says, okay, take this, and then you out the door you go, and you don't remember what you wanted to ask. We have to start training ourselves, and it almost seems that we need to role play talking up to the doctor. And we have to question this. I think we've got to find other ways to help and support people, and that is happening. In addition to the intergenerational, we've got to help older people with fix-it kinds of peoples, with visitors, and all special kinds of visitors. I know for myself, in the congregation that I had, we had 7 tape recorders, and that was a stimulus for people to visit. When they had a tape recording of the service, they took that out to visit, and it made a tremendous impact on the older people, and they appreciated that. Another area of social concern is for the church is that we need to address ourselves to the issue of overprescribing, to institutional drug control policies, and to the drug advertising practices. Many times seniors trying to save money cut down the expenses and they go buy a mail order practice, okay? And now one of the issues with that is that you don't have the relationship with a pharmacist. And that's helpful in terms of interpreting what you're taking. There are other issues which I think the church should speak to. Do you know the TV image of the older woman that's nervous, frazzled, bedraggled? She looks all awful looking, nervous. Okay, that's an issue that we should speak to. That image that TV puts out, because that's the kind of person that therefore is subject to taking drugs. We need to look upon what happens with the effect of suburbs on our culture and how the church has got to find ways of developing love and sharing. We need to help people with coping mechanisms in the face of crises. When I shared this kind of approach with an informed consumer approach to groups of pastors, to about five different groups, I hate to share with you that the pastors were kind of, speed it up, move on. They really felt that this was something that really wasn't that needed. We were hoping that pastors would be interested to consider these issues and to raise them with the senior people who were in their charge and trusted by them. And they really weren't interested. And that was a learning experience that we got out of that. And I'm not saying that everybody's in that category, but I think the issue is so new that we have to look at this, and that's why I'm saying it's a neglected ministry. Seward Hiltner, who's a professor of pastoral theology at Princeton Seminary, has a book called Toward a Theology of Aging, and he mentions four words that I share with you in closing: Sabbath, pilgrimage, vocation, and hope. He uses the word Sabbath to refer to the Jewish metaphor of considering the older years as utilizing the Sabbath as the opportunity to do what one wants to do in life. He sees pilgrimage as the concept which sees new potentialities with each step of life, that there is a connectedness to each phase of life, and that death is a positive response in the Christian understanding of the resurrection. He sees the word vocation that comes through a total life career understanding which calls to each of us in our senior years to bring out the creativity in each person. Hope is not the absence of obstacles, but a hope in the Lord, in a relationship lived in relationship and faith daily, which is completed in eternity. May each of us integrate these concerns for older adults and the issues about drug and alcohol problems into our own personal Sabbath, so that we and the persons we serve and know be equipped on our pilgrimage with a life vocation and be filled with hope. Be glad to answer any questions. Any responses?
Pastor, don't you think the problems that you've outlined here, you have to put a lot of the blame right on the medical profession? They're the ones that really foster most of this.
Well, let me say in fairness, there has been a drug explosion. There is a pharmacopoeia of drugs. And too often the drug salesman is the person who has hitherto, before continuing education for doctors, been the main source of education. You know, when you leave the hours, your appointment hours are like 9 to 11, there's usually two or three of these men with their suit briefcases, and they're trying to update the doctor on all of the drugs. And so it's a vicious pressure because he's got his hospital calls and the kinds of issues sometimes, I'm not saying in all cases, but it could well happen that he might not know all of the details about the drugs. And I don't think it's the issue of blame. I think we need to develop the kind of responsibility to be responsible for everything we put in our mouth. And I've got to work on food for myself. But and that includes medications and drugs.
Do they include vitamins in these drugs?
I don't believe so. I don't, you know, I don't want to get into nature versus vitamins and those kinds. Yes.
Don't most states have laws that govern what goes on when you get a drug? And when you give it to the bottle, now, do you understand, you know, about this drug? And if there's something you don't, he'll tell you. Isn't that required in a lot of states? It isn't our state.
Well, there are drug families and certain prescriptions that can only be renewed once or not renewable, yeah, and those kinds of things. There are those kinds of laws. But as to how the person administers the drug to themselves, that is something that is not controllable.
No, I understand that, but I mean they should have a knowledge of it when they get it.
Well, thank you for agreeing. That's what I'm saying.
We sort of are intimidated, though, by the knowledge of the doctor who gives us or tells us to take the drugs, and it's hard to ask a question about something you don't know anything about. I mean, you don't even know what to ask.
Well, these questions, though, Judy, I think would be the outline of the kind of questions that we need to ask. And those I have left on the blackboard for anyone who's interested.
Have you ever known a doctor who could answer all those questions?
Well, I think we got to talk to him about that.
Well, I have known some. They look at you and say, doesn't it help you?
Well, that's he saying, I am the authority, and if you don't like it, then get another doctor. You know, he may say that, but I happen to have a doctor that's very understanding and does take time. Now, maybe he's unusual. He also makes house calls. Over here is a question.
Well, I did have something. I've been interesting last few months. My father is 85 years old, and so he has gone from kind of one thing to the next to the next to the next. And I have learned one thing which I would really advise to a lot of people, and this is the fact, because I'm speaking up for him all the time. And this is, he has had the course of about 8 doctors in these last few months. And each one has started him on something. And so when you go to the next problem, you really alert that doctor that he was doing such and such for such. And they just stop totally what the other doctor was doing. And they progress on, because otherwise there's where the overdrugging comes in. And people just don't speak out all the time.
Let me just say, in defense of what you're saying, here's a sample form. You could have a complete medication form. Your doctor's specialty is phone, the diagnosis, date of last hospitalization, prescription drugs, and the non-prescription drugs that you take. You would have this kind of a list with you. If we were an informed consumer, you're doing that kind of service.
I'm doing it for him.
You're doing it for him.
He himself would probably be laid out by now because he'd be shot from all the drugs.
Okay. But that's, well, we could all have this.
Where would you get this? Something?
Just do it yourself. Here, copy it. And make a commitment that
really
I'm going to list this.
I've seen this, though. I mean, it's extremely important to alert each doctor, because they just going to start their set of things they're doing for each thing that you need.
Warren?
Well, I think a concern that I have as a pastor is that I talk to a lot of people about the cost of medication, and they are not covered, the drugs are not covered by most of the plans that they have, and so they're very reticent to tell the doctor what they've been getting from somebody else, because he'll just tell them that to throw it away. They feel that that's such a waste of money, and so they will self-over-medicate just not to waste the money.
Okay, that's, I think, coming out of the depression and saving. Well, we've been taught to save everything, string and everything else. But medication is a little different because the chemicals break down.
Our doctor will always ask before he prescribes a drug, what are you taking? He's very careful.
I think 90% of the doctors do this.
Okay, I think so. But let me just say, do we remember? Do we really remember? Do we tell them about the Sominex and all the other things that we take? Do we say that we also take alcohol? Do we say that?
There's only one way to get around that, and that is to write down everything that you take and everything that you eat.
Complete medication form.
That way you always have a record.
You mentioned taking high blood pressure.
Well, here's a question about food and high blood pressure.
You mentioned about food. What do you mean?
Well, certain food reactions that might react to the medication. So
never have.
Well, okay. If you want to check it out, you can check out in here in high blood pressure in this chapter, and you'll see, and it may help you for that. Sure. This is printed in large print. I would urge, it's the kind of thing that you should have available in senior centers. It would be very helpful to have. The book is called The Elderly, Their Health, and Their Drugs and Their Lives.
Do you buy it in bookstores?
No, it's the kind of thing that's not in mass circulation. It's a new field, and it's dealing with drug interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Any last question? I thank you for your attention.